Come on, bitch, let's go. Come on, get ready, bitches. Oh my gosh, you guys, such an exciting week in Bravo Land. They launched a new era in Real Housewives of New York. It's season 14 and they brought a bunch of new women on and I was excited about it. I got called by some different tabloids to give my opinion oddly about it. But anyway, I did do that. But then I was like, you know what? I want to call someone who I really respect and admire. You guys may not know this, but one of my favorite stars that was on the Real Housewives of New York, mainly for her intelligence, because she's super smart and she's an incredible businesswoman. And you know, you guys, I'm like secretly very highbrow, okay? is Heather Thompson. And so I was like, I'm going to call Heather and just see, you know, what she thought about it on the DL. So I gave Heather a call and she was like, Dana, honestly, I'm so busy with my, like, all these wonderful, fun things that she's doing. And she started telling me about them that, like, she was like, I haven't watched it. I fully support the show. I'm like all about the show, but I didn't watch it. And I said, well, let me tell you about it. And then I said, gosh, you know, the stuff you're working on is so interesting. I'm like, why aren't you talking about that? I feel like all everybody ever reaches out to you about is Real Housewives of New York, all that petty bullshit. And so I said to her, just please come on the show and tell everybody what you're doing because it's so awesome. And I also wanted to pick her brain about her early years because she was like a big deal in the fashion industry. So anyway, she did me a huge favor and she agreed because she doesn't do this kind of stuff anymore, really. And so I am now going to use an amazing angels singing sound effect to bring in the one, the only Heather Thompson.
Aw, thank you so much, Dana. What a sweet introduction. And geez, it sounded verbatim like our phone call. So I love the authenticity out the gate.
Totally. Well, I have to tell you, at least in the beginning of this, what happened on episode one, just out of the gate, so you could hear about it. I have so much to talk about with you. I'm cutting right through the hubbub because I like have a list of things I'm curious about and like advice I want you to give me and everything. Okay. Like you climbed Kilimanjaro. Like, come on.
Let's talk about it. Climbing mountains, you know, it's a metaphor to life. Let me tell you.
You're like amazing. You can take any like fluffy thing and make it deep, which is a real talent. To tell you, it's so freaking awesome.
I'm stronger than anything in my way. Holla!
So let me tell you, since you didn't see it, the gist, and I'm already dying because, okay, you and I have sort of, I think, a similar thought process, if you will, about the Real Housewives shows. And I struggle sometimes, you know, before I tell you what this is about, I struggle sometimes with the things they want the audience to believe that people are fighting over, because it's pretty clear, like, what are the real fights that are real disputes within the women and then the sort of fake ones, right? And I struggle when it isn't about a deeper issue or like something that we could all like learn from or grow from. I really do. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so on this week, I was dying. Okay. I really struggled. I loved the show and the energy of the women, but oh my gosh, wait till I tell you what the fight was about. Okay. Okay. So basically it starts out and we get introduced really rapidly to these women, some of which are legit representing New York in different capacities. other, they're just like kind of faking it. And you can tell if you're a New Yorker, you can tell. Like I was raised in New York from, I think I was like fifth grade until ninth grade. When I got like, my dad removed me to Greenwich, Connecticut, because I was like drinking in clubs at like 14 with like Drew Barrymore or whatever. But anyway.
No, it's fun anymore. Whatever happened to fun?
And I went to Nightingale Bamford in New York. And so I had a real sense of myself as a New Yorker or whatever. So I really want this show to succeed, you know, like I wanted, you know, the legacy show to succeed, whatever. So anyway, I'm watching the women for the authenticity. And so some of them really are bang on, others not so much, but we get to know them. And what we find out, the women on the show are like a real estate broker in New York City in the Hamptons. Her name's Erin Leashy. Then we have Giselle Tank. She's the fashion publicist. We have Jenna Lyons, who's big in the J. Crew landscape. She was like running that operation for a while, which maybe you've heard of her from your fashion days. There's a model, Uba Hassan, who is, I guess we find out later, related to Chanel Ayan from The Real Housewives of Dubai. And we have Bryn Whitfield, who really is from LA, but they're pretending she's from New York. And then we have Sai De Silva, who's a Brooklyn fashion influencer. Okay. And she legit is. Anyway, we get to know these women, and Erin has a really good dispute, which I like, which is like a authentic one. And she complains that Bryn and Sai were supposed to go to a group girl dinner, Heather. And then what happened was Bryn and Sai blew off the group girl dinner because the place that she chose, which everybody thinks, by the way, is Catch in New York, wasn't cool enough. And so she ended up going to Casa Cipriani to be seen instead of hanging out with her girlfriends.
Well, yeah. It's a classic, you didn't invite me to your party housewives conflict, or you didn't show up at the party housewives conflict.
Exactly.
That's pretty classic.
Yeah. So I was wondering, I'm like, I wonder if the producers were like, because they used to control where we went, you know, on Housewives of Beverly Hills. So I'm like,
Yeah. I mean, it's a location thing, simply, you know, like some places, you know, just can't have like a camera crew rolling in unbeknownst. So the producers do have a big job, you know, in front of them trying to find locations and location fees where, like, in some of the franchises, it's easier, right? Because they shoot in their homes. Whereas in Manhattan, you know, even I guess maybe that was one of the differences. I'm not sure about this one, but like at the early stages, like, you know, no one was a real highfalutin socialite in New York City. Like the real highfalutin socialites in New York City won't be on a show, right?
Totally.
Like that. So they really weren't. So like the apartments kind of came later. Do you know what I mean? Like they weren't really showing their, because in New York City, where do you go out? You go out, not at people's homes, really.
Yeah, no, because their apartments aren't that large. I mean, if you're super rich, I went to school with Ron Perlman's daughter, Hope Perlman, and we were friends, and she had, oh my gosh, her house. Oh, it was two floors. It had like a water fish tank column that went from one floor to the other. I mean, it was like outrageous.
Oh yeah. I mean, those apartments definitely exist in New York City. You know, the likes of the Barry Dillers and the Diane von Furstenberg, you know, I mean, like their pad together is like there's incredible pads in New York City, but you'll never really see them. Unless you were watching Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous New York City, I don't know that we would see that type of real estate on a Bravo franchise.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree. So this is the beginning of the fight. Now, they don't shoot this scene, okay? But what happens is, I guess she feels slighted, Erin does, by Bryn and Sai saying that they value the cool place over friendship. And that's mm-hmm. where it begins. And then it kind of goes off an edge in that we watch a little bits and pieces of the women, and then somehow the girl from LA, who's mm-hmm. supposedly from New York, says, her name's Bryn Whitfield. She says that, I guess, Sai put down Erin for serving a cheese platter or eating cheese or having cheese at her party or something, and that she somehow looked down on Aaron for this, which of course Cy denies. And Bryn says, well, that's how I interpreted it or whatever. And we watch this for like 30 minutes, literally about cheese.
So how'd you feel about life in that after that 30 minutes was over?
Yeah, I was like, can I have
that? You could never get it back.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is that what I do love is that, you know how sometimes you're acting on the show, you're sort of like, you're being you and you're authentic, but you sort of realize the cameras are there and you're on.
Yeah, I call it turning up the volume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, it gets like old and you've been at a location or a party for too long and you sort of lose that. And you're like, oh my God, get me the hell out of here. You know, like, please let me leave. So it totally happened to Jenna, but in her own apartment. So she's in her ridiculous apartment, which is very cool and funky with this giant, like, Sex in the City shoe closet, which she collects shoes. So that's cool. Anyway,
got the shops behind her to do it.
Exactly. And that was enjoyable because it was authentic, you know, yes. Like, yeah,
that's it.
And
isn't
so what
you want isn't really at the, I mean, look, honestly, to cut to the chase, not to blow up your podcast, but like, I think at the end of the day, that's just what I personally, you and I, we've talked about it. It's just like more authenticity, more. Why not?
Yeah. And she was so funny because Jenna, they catch her at the end of the evening. She's like, I just can't talk about cheese anymore.
You still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man.
Y'all
trying,
already?
Oh, yeah, I'm trying to get them on there. Yeah. We all artists, man. We go, you feel me? We gonna have this like,
bro, me and my man Kyle, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now.
Shit.
I gotta lie, we play with this shit right now for real. I gotta lie.
Don't play with it. No. Take that shit serious.
That's funny. Those are the one-liners or the moments about the show. Listen, at the end of the day, you know, I think at this point, I was so serious too. You know what I mean? Like, because I was really like you opened the show saying, like, it's hard for you when you're not really getting into the deeper issue or it's more purpose or something like that. And, you know, I think that could be said for any scenario in life. Like if you're listening to a conversation at a cocktail party and the subject someone's talking about is like not something you're interested in, you kind of can't wait till you get your, like, you or someone else gets their shot in the break in the conversation and be like, oh, that reminds me. I ate cheese in the south of France. That was amazing. Whatever.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the south of France. I guess what you're telling me, which is interesting to me, because as you know, I wasn't really following it. I wish them all the best, like you said, and all the support in the world. And I hope they have great success and that the fans are super happy and everybody's super happy. For me, it was just interesting that it didn't, like you said, it was like the fight, like who didn't invite who to whose party or who didn't show up. The fight seems the same. What will be interesting is if, because the truth of the matter, Dana, and you can speak to this as well, is that for some of the players on these types of shows, that slight really hurts. That slight is real. And it really feels like, yo, we just started together. Like, how you already going somewhere else? And that's where you and I could say, or a very seasoned watcher of the show, well, maybe production made them do that or whatever. But the bottom line is that if the feeling is genuine and she's really slighted, I certainly hope that they can get into that, because that would be, for me, that would be exciting television if I were to watch it.
You know? We're so in sync. Cause I was like, they let that fight go and we went on to cheese. And I was like, that's the fight. That's a real New York fight. Like, women being snooty to each other is a real New York thing. It happens. I mean,
or especially going to the hotter party or the hotter location. I mean, that's even a college thing. Yeah, right? Like we've all been through that or had it done to us or feel like it was done to us or it was really done to us, you know?
Right. Yeah. And a real New Yorker would never choose the hot place over friends. And I was like dying for Aaron to be like, that's why you're a transplant. Like, you know,
you
like
wanted the line, you felt the line in your blood. And those are the fun times when you can. And I love that people are invested in, you know, any franchise for that reason, whether it's reality television or it's something like Yellowstone. You just can't wait to see what the character's going to do next because you love her.
What do you want?
To make a scene. You ready to watch that happen?
You know?
Yeah.
So I think it's all really good. And I love that you called me to ask me about it because, you know, it is interesting because, you know, there is a lot going on, you know, so if you were to die, because I don't really, as you know, I don't really talk about the, you know, the show or any of that stuff. I had my moment. I felt like I had my sunset and I feel really good about it. You know, some people may have, you know, may think I burned a bridge. I don't. I think that it was all authentic and honest and true and everybody involved in it knew what it was. So if they want to hold a certain sort of, you know, or feel a certain sort of way about it, I can't, you know, I can't control that. But for me, it's like, you know, all hands on the table, like everybody, you know, knows where our relationships are at and how we feel. So I feel really good about that. I'm just very interested as a, you know, from an intellectual standpoint, from a social experiment and where we are as a human species, you know, where we start to come to a place where the truth, the conscious, the authentic is really becoming important and not really being entertained with, you know, there's so much great fiction out there. I think when we're watching reality, I mean, that's what we really want to watch, right? Isn't that why everybody watches like all the crime stories? Like, is that why they're popular? Because it's true. So taken aback by the way someone else handles a situation or like you just did, may finish a sentence or handle a situation just like you. And you're like, I knew it. She did it. That's fun. That's super fun television and super fun to watch.
My ideal show, and then I'd love to hear yours, but my ideal show, I actually had an idea. Let me tell you this idea.
Tell me, shoot it out, girl.
Okay. So it was actually an art exhibit, not a show, but I thought it would be so amazing if you put a cube of like an apartment at Art Basel in Miami, which is the big art show.
Sure.
And you put like people in there and you gave them all, I don't know, a job or a role in there. And they had to exist as if it was that role. And you could just watch them like an art exhibit for a few days. Like, do they sleep? Do they fight? Do they, but no interaction with any producers. Like, it's just an art exhibit. You know how they have those interactive? And then in the interaction of it, you could request things to see what would happen for the art exhibit. So like you could say, but you're not like, you know, within reason. Okay. No sickos.
Well, you never know, girl.
That's where the censorship comes in. But like, you know, you like within these parameters, you could set things in motion and then, you know, you could watch it unfold. I just thought that would be so cool. And I feel like that would make a good reality shows going a little bit more back to reality for me would be really exciting. What's your like idea if you were like doing a show?
Yeah. All right. To put it in your cube, right? I would say you can't get rid of production, obviously. And I don't mean that. There's a really important jobs in Hollywood and we're all on strike right now and all the things are going crazy.
On Thursday, the SAG-AFTRA Actors Union voted to go on strike for the first time since 1980, effectively shutting down Hollywood's scripted movie and television industry. The move came just over 2 months after the Writers Guild of America went on strike, halting production of many popular shows like Saturday Night Live. Writers and actors are in a tug of war with studios over who gets paid and how much in this new era of streaming and artificial intelligence.
I just think it's a battle worth fighting.
Netflix broke open the industry model with House of Cards, forever changing the way creatives were compensated. By keeping their viewership private, Netflix upended the residual model that made the writers and casts of shows like Friends tens of millions of dollars in broadcast syndication every year, paying them up front, but not rewarding success for hit shows. The Writers Guild and SAG-AFTRA demanding change.
Something is going to happen which is going to force people back to the table. Eventually there will be a deal.
but it's going to be a rocky, rough road getting there.
We're just going to stop and say we're pro WGA.
Yeah, pro WGA. Of course, of course, of course. I mean, so much is changing so quickly, you know, out there in the world and, you know, keeping up with it, whether it's through protections for, you know, writers and actors, you know, we're moving quickly and there's not a lot of policy to back, you know, the speed or the change. But I think back to what you were asking me is, it would be to limit the producers from my own experience, you know, would be to limit that type of, because I think sometimes, and I've even had these conversations, you know, with like Carol Radziwell or you know, someone who's a girlfriend of mine who comes out of this business, who understands journalism and television and production and things like that. You know, and we've had disagreements on it because she's like, yeah, it wouldn't work that way because you had like the infrastructure has to work a certain sort of way. But to that point, I think that's not her point, but my point is to that point, I think sometimes a production house or a producer may feel as though they know the ropes and they know what the audience expects and they know, or they feel they know how to get the ratings. And so to your point, I think maybe taking the risk as a network and letting the people just play might be, you know, refreshing. You know what I mean? In a oversaturated reality existence today.
You really just nailed that landing. By the way, I want to say this to you. Holla.
Yeah, girl, holla. Those are the things. It's not like I don't talk about Housewives. My experience on the show, my experience from it to this day, even talking to you. I mean, you didn't call me. I know you think I'm, you know, a great entrepreneur and you're really excited about a lot of things I have done. And I'm really excited about that too. And that's why we're talking, but it ain't why you called me. Right. So let's just be real. So I think that the identity that, you know, Housewives afforded me is that's the part that I want to keep paying for. That's the part that I'm so excited about to this day. And that's the part I'm excited about for anybody who's been on the franchise, wants to be on the franchise, may become a franchise housewife. You know, what can you do with the platform? And, you know, if you or I judged one another on solely maybe what we saw on a screen, like maybe we wouldn't even be talking today. So I think having an open mind for your own conclusions, generally speaking in life, like I'm doing that more and more, not passing judgment. Like I think one of the funnest things about television is like the laughing out loud factor, you know, that relatability. Let's just talk about like Myra on Schitt's Creek.
Hey there, roses.
Oh, hi.
Look at you two bargain hunters. You finding anything yet?
Nothing you couldn't see fall out of a common Christmas cracker.
How, like, I could just watch that show over and over and over again because they made me laugh out loud. And being a fashion industry girl and just the writing, it's just the whole premise of it was, and the acting, of course. I mean, you can't, that was so fun. So when you have a synergistic opportunity like that with any group of cast, whether they're reality or they're not reality, you got to make people laugh. And I think that that's the part that maybe unscripted shows are victims of, because the people who are on it feel such pressure to be entertainers and not really themselves.
I disagreed with everybody in the newspapers today when I was asked. So what happened was I was asked, who was your favorite housewife? And I said Jenna Lyons, because I could just watch her for an hour with nothing else happening around her because she's so unique.
That's cool.
But all of the papers were saying that the fact that she doesn't fit in and she seems awkward and her weird idiosyncrasies don't seem to jive with the girls. And I felt like saying, so you mean because she's not formulaic?
Right. And if we've learned anything as a society today, like we're not, you know, cookie cut, you know what I mean? Like individualism should be celebrated. And so that's just, you know, seems, of course, I'm going off of not seeing anything, but just by the nature of the comment, it doesn't feel like something I would support.
Exactly. Exactly. And let me just say, you said something really smart to Bethany Frankel on her show when she had it. You said the best way to have a brand is on a reality show. And that was one of the big reasons that you came on to Real Housewives of New York, because mm-hmm. you recognize as a business person, besides it being fun and all these other things, that you could build a brand. And you, at that time, were so successful. Like, I need you to tell everybody who isn't familiar about your early years with P. Diddy. You know, you helped him, like, what? You founded it, didn't you, with him? And then you did J-Lo and Beyonce. Can you tell me a little bit about that time? Because if you remember, I had said to you, I went to Puff Daddy's white parties in the Hamptons a few years. Yes. And I
that's
said,
got me. That's how he hooked me.
And I said, I bet I ran into you. And I was like, too fucked up to even know. But but I was like, I bet I ran into you at those parties. And I was like, they were so epic, you know, because they are epic. They are epic.
Well, it's a good segue, Dina, because they were epic and he created something epic. He is epic. And what's interesting about it is the time. So yeah, I'm 53 years old now. You know what I mean? So like when I worked for Puffy, I was in my early 30s. And, you know, we're the same exact age. His birthday is 11/04/69. I can still tell you. And we were making history and we were, you know, breaking barriers and we were breaking the rules and we were loud and proud and, you know, Black excellence. They didn't even really formed what that saying was or that word was or that phrase was, those words were, but we were living it. And it was such an incredibly exciting time and such an important movement for so many reasons.
But like, how did you meet him? Can I ask you, like, give me some details because I'm dying. Okay, please tell me a story.
I'll go back to how I met Puffy, but I just will finish the sentence that also Jennifer and Beyonce were revolutionary to just look at what we were told was acceptable as females before Jennifer Lopez rolled onto the scene where everybody could be more accepted. And a lot of people could finally feel like they had a plate at the table. You know what I mean? Because of a certain physique. So they were very empowering times. And or the way I met Puffy was very organically and authentically as a fashion designer. At the time I was working for Polo Jeans Company, was in business and it was licensed through a vertical operation. And I was working as a designer for that vertical operation. And I was spending a lot of time on Polo Jeans, a lot of time on finishing the denim, really becoming an expert in denim as a classification. And there was a publication that was in circulation at the time called DNR, and it stood for Daily News Record. And for anybody who's in the fashion industry or has ever even gotten a glimpse at a Women's Wear Daily, a WWD magazine, DNR was the answer to Women's Wear Daily in the men's world. So DNR had published an article that Puffy was launching a clothing line. They hadn't really named it. They were telling us a little bit about it. And so I read the article. I found out later the article was planted in the trade publication because they were really trolling for partners at the time, someone to partner with Puffy on the launch of his company, Sean John. But it was a little bit, you know, like vague. You couldn't really tell. But I looked at the article and I went to the CEO of the company and I said, listen, if these guys do this right, this is the next big thing. Celebrity brands. Like I just saw it. I said, and if they do it wrong, we have a vertical operation and we're going to make a shit ton of jeans off of this guy's name for a hot second. Like we need to jump into this and see what's going on.
So smart, because you guys, just so you know, at this time that Heather's talking about, jeans and denim was the hottest commodity. There were jean companies everywhere popping up trying to like compete in this sector. So
everywhere. And like Polo Jeans as a company, as a license of Ralph Lauren, doesn't even exist anymore. Like, you know, he just went into RRL or something, but like everybody was launching denim lines. It's so important that you said that it's true. Like Polo Jeans, DKNY, you know, everybody.
Rockin' Republic, remember?
Oh, Rockin' Republic. And at the same time that was happening, and let me just say Tommy Hilfiger, bless his soul, I love him so much.
Oh my God, you met Tommy Hilfiger?
Oh my, I used to work for him.
Shut up. Oh, you have to tell me about that.
Oh my God. Tommy was the one who told me, you need to be an entrepreneur. You need to go work for, you need to own your own business and be the boss. He's the one that told me that. You go be the boss.
And, what's he like? What was he like?
Oh, Tommy Hilfiger is one of the kindest, most talented, humble, family, entrenched in his family type of guy. He'll reach out to anybody with a lending hand, a helping hand. He's like your neighbor next door.
What did you learn from him? Tell me what you learned from him.
Oh my God. Tommy, I started my career at Tommy Hilfiger. I was working in intimate apparel at the time. I was doing like bathrobes and loungewear. And we signed the license, the company I was working for at the time, we signed the license for Tommy Hilfiger intimates. So now I was starting to learn bras and panties. Like I had known like the loungewear pajama game as a young designer. Now I was getting into real technical design with, you know, bras and panties and that sort of thing. And it was with Tommy Hilfiger that I really learned the ropes. And that was the earliest days as Tommy. We're talking like, you know, 1990, you know, I'm even going to think 88.
He was so huge. Can I just tell you?
I'm going to tell you when it was. We're talking 1994.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. I know exactly.
Tommy
was
like the height of, and what was also happening with him at the same time, which was so unbeknownst to my life experience, but Tommy was getting picked up by street fashion. Hip hop was really getting into Tommy Hilfiger. And so at the same time, that was becoming a revolution for, you know, like Made in America, the American flag, like USA fashion, where Ralph Lauren was standing for one thing, Tommy was standing for the streets. And it was such an interesting time in fashion because, you know, brands like For Us, By Us, FUBU, you know, and Cross Colors and Karl Kanai. I mean, Fat Farm hadn't even launched yet, you know, so what was happening was, you know, Black America and Brown America was starting to get into fashion for us, by us, starting to, you know, call out to their people that we don't have to file in behind something that's really not for us. But at the same time, they were making Tommy Hilfiger for them, really making it a part of the streets, a part of their culture. And Tommy, as like, I think the board of directors, and you can look at their history, they were really interested and probably worried on one level to see like, what would this mean for a brand, you know?
Well, and also Tommy Hilfiger is like, his depiction is kind of a rich white guy.
He's not. He's from Elmira, New York. He came from a very humble beginning and humble parents and a big family.
Wow.
And so it was, so I think that's honestly, I'm really glad you brought it up. It was the true colors of Tommy Hilfiger and his brother, Andy. Like Andy was out there making music and they're both musicians. They come from a family of musicians and they love rock and roll. So Tommy stayed true to who he was and it really turned into music. It
that's
was
why, that's Hilfiger awesome.
Being all about music. So at the same time, like all that's going on.
And you know what? I went to the opening of Tommy Hilfiger on Rodeo Drive and he discovered Gwen Stefani. She had just come out and she hosted that event. And I could never understand why they chose a musician to do that opening. And you just put that together for me. Oh my God.
Gwen, so many musicians that they were so instrumental in, in being a part of, you know, Quincy Jones's daughter. But how it relates to my life is that while that was happening, I was really learning the craft of denim. And really becoming an expert at, you know, as a denim designer and finisher. And like you said, denim was so important at the time that when Puffy was launching his collection, it was really jeans were one of the most important pieces of the collection. So we met through that article. I called them up. This cat, Jeff Tweedy, was working there at the time. He was the only guy in the company pretty much beside Puff. I was like the second or third hire in the company. And we started the revolution, and that's really the truth. And So the
I love that you got in there, though. That you.
Oh my God, I did.
I mean, how did you hustle that? He was a very he's a sweetheart.
I started it because I had a good job and I was really happy in my job and I was really fulfilled. I was in this really creative space. I was living in New York. I just loved it. And Puffy, the article came along, and so I was interested in making his jeans. But the conversation with the owner of the factories, the owner of the company, and the owner and Puffy, like they just stalled out the gate. Like Puffy was like, it was like the business, the arrangement, the personalities was not happening. But Puffy was like, but you, I want, like meaning me, you know? And I was like, oh no, thanks. I felt really secure in my position at the time. And I was given the opportunity by one of my mentors at the time who said, you have to take this opportunity because I know you're gonna sail with it. Like it will be your wave. Like you will be able to be a part of something really important. And I know that you have the capacity to take this risk and jump. And so like sometimes when things are going really good in your life and you don't expect this door to open, it opens and you have to walk through it. And so I took a leap of faith, and the white party did have something to do with it because Puffy invited me to one of his first white parties and nobody could get in. Like Naomi was like stuck. Naomi Campbell was like stuck at the front door. It was a fire code thing. Like they simply couldn't let any more people in. And he was like parading me around the party, introducing me as his designer. So like the next day I was like, I might want that job. And so the rest is history, and we made fashion history together. And I feel like, you know, even though we're the same age, he's a sort of big brother to me. His sons and daughters, I love them dearly from afar now. Everybody moved to LA, and his mama is, you know, close to my heart. I can say the same thing really about the Knowles family, Beyonce and Tina, and my years with Jennifer and her mom, Lupe, and all of the relationships and the people. We were in it, and we worked as hard as anybody could ever work. I mean, I did, I worked for three of the triple threats in Hollywood. So if you want to ask me where I learned my work ethic, I'll tell you that I started from, you know, being a like kind of middle-class kid up in a country setting with parents who were like, you can do whatever you want to do, but you know, just you got to get after it yourself.
Yeah. you have to do it yourself.
I really learned that I was capable of anything through with Puffy, Jen, and Beyonce.
Did they work hands-on Beyonce?
Oh, yeah.
Like
oh,
Beyonce
yeah.
came in and was like, Heather, oh my I'd God, like to yeah. see like
oh,
this.
Yes, yes. I had them all in what I call their best years because they were still, not that they're not young and scrappy, but they were really young and scrappy. And they weren't of the iconic status that they are today, 30 years later. You know, I mean, like we're talking, you know, Puffy and I go back a long time. Jennifer and I go back. I mean, I met Jennifer because Puffy and she were dating. And we became, you know, friends and kindred spirits. And she had such an interest in design. And we had a lot of downtime waiting for Puff. And so we became friends. We talked about design and fashion. And then
I bet course, she and you got along really great because you both are high energy.
Yeah. Well, they all are. And, you know,
Beyonce high energy?
Very high energy. Oh, she's a workaholic. Beyonce is like, I mean, a perfectionist, and that can obviously as a personality trait can be a positive or a negative. But when we're talking about it in Beyonce's, as an artist, her work ethic and her perfection are like second to none. It just because she really, like, she's at the editing thing herself. Like she's just super amazing. They all are incredible. I was so lucky to have the opportunity to grow in my own career as they were growing their own careers and to do it together, make fashion history together, break some rules together, grow up together. I mean, we're all about the same age. Beyonce was my young boss. It was so funny because Jen and Puffy and I are all the same age. So then when I started working with Beyonce, I was like, yo, my boss is like a good 12 years younger than me or something like that she was. And it is. And it was so interesting.
Well, it's really funny to listen to you tell this story, because there's so many like gossip stories flying around about like Beyonce's age and Puff Daddy, and that he's like not, you know, you have such a different depiction than the going gossip. That's why I love it, because it's aww, like somebody who knows them firsthand, you know.
Well, commenting. I guess the gossip is like the edited reality show, right? And I'm going to tell you what's real behind the scenes. And
yeah.
You know, exactly. I have such an affinity and affection for all of them. And when I say all of them, like, you know, behind Puff and behind Beyonce and behind Jen are, you know, throngs of teams and people, you know, from Orbe, rest in peace, you know, to people, amazing, talented, you know, makeup artists like Mally and Scott Barnes and Andrea Lieberman as a stylist and designer, and June Ambrose, you know, and all these incredible people, Yvette Knowles Shore. I'm talking about the teams that are behind these incredible people, the Alan Nirobs, you know, I could just go on and on. So that was the best part of it. And I think that that's the part that really formed who I am. It was watching the incredible work ethic, the taking no, you know, no for an answer and no prisoners at the same time, like not taking no for an answer and taking no prisoners, and just working your finger to the bone or doing whatever it needed to do to make the show go on. And I fit in really well in that atmosphere. And so I think that's what was exciting, you know, for me starting my own businesses, that I just had so much confidence. Like I was,
is that how you did Yummy?
Yes. When I started Yummy, my own business, which is why I left Beyonce. I had my three kids. I only have two children, by the way. I just said I have three. Yeah. I'm looking here at my dog. My dog is looking at me right now, and like the number three came to my head. So I'm like, there's my
child. I love it. I know. I was about to say, wait a minute. I thought you just did Jackson Ellis. Something really scandalous happening now.
I'm telling you right now. I had my two children with Beyonce, and you know, this was a time, you know, she and Jay weren't even married yet. You know, they were very much together, but they weren't even married yet. And Solange was pregnant with Jules. Me and Jax, I was pregnant with Jax, and Beyonce was scared to have a baby. She was like, she watched Solange's birth with Jules, and she was like, "What? No, I'm not going to.
I'm not doing it.
That's scary." You know, so like that's an incredible, beautiful insight into Beyonce as a human being, a vulnerable human being.
Yeah, and she's not alone. Paris Hilton was afraid of having a baby. I mean, a lot of women are.
Maybe not a lot of women should watch it. I never watched it, so I didn't know what was. I still don't know what I got myself into at the end of the day. But I'm certainly happy with the result.
Listen, if I had known, I did all of this stuff like water birthing, and I did like training for 6 months, and like any way you could buy something to do with childbirth, I bought it. In the end of the day, they were like, "He's stuck, C-sectioner."
Oh my God, that's so funny. The best laid plans, right? Well, I don't know about this, but just to totally segue for anyone who is going to have a baby, wants to have a baby, is thinking about having a baby. Those of us that are not or don't want to, don't have to worry about it. But I highly implore you to take a mirror and do not ignore it, and look down there after you have a baby to see what the heck you just did.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's so intense.
I mean, so intense.
I'm going to do a nice sound effect for all women who've had babies and or C-sections and are contemplating it, because in the future, this is for you.
Waiting for you and the power you possess in your satin tights, fighting for your rights and the old red, white, and blue.
Absolutely. I love it. And for those of you who've decided not to, hallelujah for you too, or whatever that sound effect is for you.
That's right. There's like Chelsea Handler somewhere is going, I'm so glad I passed on that.
So fun. I love people who stand, you know, up for what they believe in, fearlessly, flawed, you know, all that kind of stuff. She's super brave. I think she's so funny and cool. I really respect the freedom of speech. Respect the freedom of speech always, of course. But like,
You're all about it.
Yeah, you got to have it.
You're living fearlessly. You're really mantra oriented. I went to your retreat and it was like the pure freedom retreat. Then I was like, the podcast is living fearlessly. I'm like, if I just hang out with Heather, I'm definitely going to become a better person.
All the mantras, unfortunately, come from like the battle scars and the wounds of life. But thank God for them all, because at the end of the day, every single experience that we have is what forms us and develops us into who we are. And unfortunately, we were kind of sold a bill of goods and story told to about like white picket fences and all that kind of stuff, which, by the way, they exist, but they never remain stagnant. Like nothing is impermeable. Like there will always be change. And so knowing that the ebb and the flow, like that dip is as much a part of living as the high, the good, the picket fence, the hurricane, the door blown through, you know, that's as much of living as the picket fence and, you know, the 2.5 kids. Like, so I think if we can start consciously to set our minds about the balance, the perspective, you know, the truth that we really hear in our own heads versus the stories we tell ourselves or that we believe through society, you know, we're off to a better place. But the only way we could get there is through the travesty, through the heartache, through the pain, through the reckoning, the acknowledgement, then the tolerance of how to live with it.
Yeah, it's called character building shit.
Yes.
I don't say it as well as you do, but you know what?
No, I think that that's a perfect way to build it. And so if we looked at it as character building, geez, it's just one of those things, right, Dana? Like, what would you say to yourself 5 years ago, 10 years ago? It's the beauty of aging, but it's also the dilemma of aging, is because no one really gets it until they experience it. You can tell them you're blue in the face. But you have to be 53 or somewhere there about that to really understand what I'm saying. If not, you just have a preface to the book.
Oh my gosh, Heather, I swear to gosh, I started looking at all of the products on your webpage, you know, because they're all like, you know, good for you and they promote all these healthy things. And I'm just falling apart over here. You know, I just turned 50 and you look fabulous, by the way. I just have to say it. I mean, you're obviously, you work out a lot. You take great care of yourself. You eat well, you know, you're living your health and wellness. And apparently I'm not, but looking at your website and I was like, oh my gosh, I need to try out this shit.
It's not as easy as we think it should be, right? On one hand, but on the other hand, it's a lot simpler than we make it. So we do have these barriers, you know, like are up against us in terms of, you know, eating well, clean nutrition, you know, what's healthy for us. We're told and we're sold a lot of propaganda. And at the end of the day, getting to this point is not easy. But if you can eat a largely plant-based diet where you're not really overindulging in, you know, fat and dairy and alcohol and, you know, anything processed like the perfecta of a potato chip, because those things turn on, you know, your dopamine levels and they're modified by genetics in a factory that, you know, once you pop, you can't stop and no one can eat just one. They're real advertisements. They're telling you exactly what they've made for you. So when we as a society of consumers can understand and also have the privilege of choice, we're going to be doing a lot better. And so if you just knowing that the food industry is against you, big pharma doesn't want you healthy, you know, eating healthy and being healthy, the only person that benefits is you. and yeah. your family. It doesn't benefit the healthcare industry. It doesn't benefit the insurance industry, right? Well, and it doesn't benefit the food industry, because most of the food that we want to eat when we're eating clean and healthy, we don't overeat. We yeah. don't overindulge. Like, I've never overindulged in blueberries. I don't know about you. I've no. definitely eaten too much of my share of chips, but I can't say, God, I can't have another blueberry. I just can't fit another one. You know, so like,
so true.
So being not led by the pack, not led by the bumpers of society, but truly starting to listen to ourselves, learn about the truths and the propaganda out there, and be our own advocates and be kind to ourselves, in a lot better place.
Well, you're talking to someone who's on semaglutide right now. So. Mm-hmm. I felt like telling you, you know, what happened was Terry Dubrow from Botched and Real Housewives of Orange County, Heather Dubrow's husband.
Yes, of course. I know Terry and Heather.
Yeah. So Terry went out and did like this video, and he was like, he covered, of course, Lisa Marie Presley's autopsy and all this. Yeah. And he then communicated about the fact that she had had that surgery where they removed the intestine and reconnected. And then she also was on a form of semaglutide. I don't know if it was Ozempic or another. And he was saying, I'm really sick of people not talking about the bad side effects of these types of medicines, which are allowing people to lose a lot of weight. And then he went on and talked about it. Let me play it for you.
Let's talk about weight loss surgery, bariatric surgery. There are several different kinds. I have read Lisa Marie's autopsy report. She had the most advanced kind. Basically, you disconnect part of the intestines, so you just don't absorb as much food, and that's how you get calorie restriction. So she had bypassed part of her intestines. They made a new connection between her stomach and her intestines. And the most common complication when you go inside the abdomen and do that kind of surgery is that scar tissue forms, and that's called adhesions. And occasionally, at any time in the future, when you've had this type of bypass bariatric surgery, those adhesions can block parts of the small intestine and cause what's called a small bowel obstruction. And that can lead to a process, if it goes on long enough, called strangulation, where the intestines actually died. And that's what happened to her. And what's really scary is 915 centimeters, which means 30 feet of her small intestines had died before she made it to the hospital. I have another theory that I want to share with you. Most patients who have had previous bariatric bypass surgery, they lose a lot of weight, but not enough, okay? So a lot of them, particularly in Hollywood, are on the Ozempic type drugs. Recent studies have shown that if you're on Ozempic type drugs, they can slow down your intestines. They can predispose you to intestinal obstruction. And there may be the perfect unfortunate storm of previous surgery with intestinal scarring, opioid use, so you can't tell that you're that sick, and further slowing of the intestines by the use of these miracle weight loss drugs that virtually everyone is on in Hollywood. Now, I don't know that she was on that, but we will know when the further toxicology comes back. If you're going to go on the Ozempic type drugs and you get intestinal pain, you get stomach bloating, you get pain, you drink alcohol with this, you're predisposed to intestinal obstruction and pancreatitis. And right now, I have three of my patients who are on Ozempic, okay, that haven't even had surgery yet, in the hospital, two in the ICU with intestinal and pancreatitis just from the use of Ozempic. Nobody's talking about this right now, but we need to talk about it.
So that's kind of scary for, you know, someone like me who's on it. Now, I haven't had any indicators of these things, but obviously, if you look back and you get an issue with your kidney or pancreas,
yes, of course,
and you've lost 20 pounds, that's great. But now you're dead. It's not
so. No, exactly. Yeah. So, Dina, why did you decide to take it? Why did you choose Ozempic as your journey? Or can you share some of that?
I love you, my journey. You sound like me in season 2 of The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, taking Kyle and Kim Richards on a journey and an adventure. I'm definitely coming to one of your retreats. I'm going to save my money and come. So it's not Ozempic. So Ozempic is the name brand. It's like the Versace of the shirt, right? And yeah. And semaglutide is like the generic name for right. this blocker or whatever. So basically, I'm on a semaglutide. To be fair to Ozempic, I don't want to say that I'm on them and I'm
yeah,
not.
Yeah, which is know. A blocker and the generic of what they're touting their product to do.
Correct. And so I inject myself once a week. I've been on 7 weeks. I lost 11 pounds. And the reason I went on this journey, as you so eloquently stated, is that I hit 50 and I could no longer lose weight. And I felt like I gave up most alcohol. I was doing intermittent fasting. I was working out a little, not enough. I was eating pretty clean. I'd say B on that. And I was stuck. And I started to get very sad.
Yep.
Because I felt frustrated with my body, because my body is letting me down as I go into my 50s. And it makes me feel vulnerable because things that I could count on before I can't count on anymore. And the psychological...
You and 100 million women. We're one of the few countries, just so everybody knows, in the world that allows pharmaceutical companies to directly advertise to consumers. Okay. So like, you know, we're one of the few, you know, nations that you can go into your doctor and like, yo, I want Ozempic. Like most people don't know what they're asking for. Their doctors still prescribe the medicines and have the relationships with the pharmaceutical companies. In here in the United States, they are directly advertising to you. So yeah. The whole silver bullet, you know, theory, I'm just going to put that on the table as I just don't believe in it, right? But the other thing that I want to put on the table, there may be no silver bullet, right? But there are definitely what I would call kickstarts, jump starts, supportive ways to get you to a place where you feel functional. And you feel maybe more in control, right? So I think, you know, obviously science and medicine, I am a product of. Look at Jax. You know, he had a liver transplant. If I had turned my back on modern medicine, I wouldn't have my kid, right? But on top
of- By the way, how is he?
He's 18 and thriving and just incredible and strong and wonderful. And at the same time, understanding, you know, the side effects, the medications that he has to take to keep him alive may have or will have or could have on him, not only short-term, but long-term side effects. Like one of the long-term side effects of one of Jax's medicines is cancer, namely skin cancer. So knowing that up front, what does that mean for Jax? We got an SPF up, right? We got a mineral sunscreen, you, because you already know that you're a precursor for those things. So that's a medicine, right? That is making my son Jax vulnerable, right? But there are other things that make us vulnerable as human beings, whether it's our DNA, our cursors, it's our lifestyle, it's the time of our life, what we're going through, stress, menopause, right? So like in your 50s, that's exactly when you start to gain stubborn weight or you recognize that stubborn weight is there and not easy to get off, right? We gain in our 30s, starting in our 30s, if you don't make any change in your life, you're going to gain a pound a year as you age based on metabolism shifts and
yes.
hormones and all that kind of stuff, right? So why wouldn't a company like an advertiser of pharmaceuticals on television that are blockers like yours or are an Ozempic name brand say 90% of women at the age of 50 experience weight gain. Check with your doctor before, but if you don't have something, then maybe we can help, right? So like we're not told that we're not singled out, that we are actually part of the herd, that we are amongst so many people with the same problems. Now, the difference between Eastern and Western medicine is that our doctors here are trained in treatment, not in prevention. So if you have weight gain in your 50s, they're going to put you in a bucket of a bunch of women that have weight gain in their 50s, and they're going to say, okay, so Ozempic works for that. right? If you have a migraine, they're going to put you in a bucket of a bunch of people that have migraine, and they're going to treat you the same way. When you get into Eastern medicine, they start to, they ask about who you are as a person, which is what we're dealing with today in America, called integrative nutrition or integrative medicine. So instead of treating you linear, like everybody else that has a migraine, which is how doctors in this country are taught, and thank God they are, because it has its benefits. But the other option is treating you as a bio individual. Tell me about your life. Tell me about your lifestyle. Tell me about the types of things you eat. Tell me about your job, your marriage. Tell me about your family history. Now they're going to treat Dana, who has a migraine, maybe very differently than Heather, who has a migraine, because they're looking at us bio individually.
Yeah.
So that would be my advice to anybody like you. First of all, congratulations on your weight loss, because yeah. I know it's
I'm risking my life, but yeah.
But on the other moment, when the Ozempic has to go away, when the silver bullet, the support that you need, the kickstart maybe that you may have needed, is no longer there because it's not a long-term solution.
Yeah.
What have you learned? And how can you apply those things into your journey and your goal as we age, mature, and understand more about our bodies and ourselves?
Well, I'll tell you the thing I will take away from this experience, if I survive it, because based on Terry's thing, I'm scared, but
you're going to survive it.
I'm going to my doctor next week.
He's meaningful. He has his own product lines, and he really comes out with things that he really feels like are going to help people. I really believe that. We worked together at Shop HQ for many years.
You know, after he did that, I made an appointment with my doctor because I may take risks, but I'm not stupid. So I immediately said, I'm going to go in and talk to my doctor about it and make sure I don't have any symptoms of this, or, you know, have her weigh out
precursors. Yeah, I know a lot of commercials say that, but to your listeners, if you want to take something, or if you've decided that you want to take something, oftentimes today we can go into our doctors and we can say, I would like to try Ozempic, and they'll ask you a couple reasons and they'll prescribe it, right? There are other doctors that may, you know, spend more time with you on it. The bottom line is you have to be your own advocate. You have to know what you're going into and how it could hurt you, and know like your blood, what it looks like before you take the medicine. There's a lot of new advancements in medicine in the terms of like at home and understanding from an at home kit what your markers are. So there's a company, there's so many of them right now, but one I can talk about particularly because I experienced it. Chris Robbins launched a new company called Life Force. And what they do is they send you a kit, and you take and a phlebotomist comes to your home and draws your blood. And don't quote me, you guys can look it up, but it's like a $350 charge or something like that. And the phlebotomist comes to your house and they do a full workup. It's almost like, you know, like a CEO's, you know, health exam, Dana.
That's
you know
cool.
what I'm saying? Like, because yeah. what happens, it's like an executive health exam. Because what happens is our insurance companies will oftentimes limit the doctor into the blood test they can take unless there's a precursor. But like for me, when I was going through perimenopause, I was dealing in hormone therapy or looking at hormone therapy. And I learned there are three ways to take hormones as a woman. There's a patch, there's a pellet, they shoot it in your ass like Star Trek style. And then there is bioidentical hormones, which is like a cream you rub on your skin. It's topical. And they're not all created the same. Bioidentical is the only one that actually reads your blood and then matches your dose specifically to what you're missing or what you have too much of or not enough of.
Oh, that's really good.
A little bit more cookie cutter, right? So, but they work for a lot of people, and they're still a great therapy for a lot of people, but maybe for some, there aren't. It's kind of always in life like a 1-2 punch. Like it's never like one thing. It's like, okay, I'm going to address this and I'm going to address this.
I'm going to tell you what I'm going to keep. I'm going to do the intermittent fasting from 9 p.m. to 2 p.m. that I'm keeping after I'm done. I'm going to really watch my portion control. And I'm not going to drink alcohol unless a special occasion. Really, really, almost never.
Well, I love that because those are three things that work for Dana. And those are Dana's bio individual plan. One of the things that I want to say about intermittent fasting, just for the listeners, even for yourself, if you don't know it, like we naturally fast in as human beings during the night when we're sleeping, during recovery and restoration is a natural time of fasting. What's not natural, which is why intermittent fasting really works for a lot of people, is we are not naturally sleeping through the circadian rhythm of when we're supposed to restore and recover. And we're eating late into the night. And then our bodies are working at digestion when they're supposed to be restoring. And so, you know, it is a very natural state for a body while it's in a sleep state to be in a fat burn. You're supposed to burn fat while you sleep, right? But oftentimes we derail that natural rhythm of the body, not only because of what the time we ate, but sometimes what we ate.
So what's a good time to do it before bed?
So for me, what really works for me in order to kind of not gain weight or keep my weight, and it's a schedule I try to keep, but when I go off it, what do? I just get back on it the next day because life can't always be scheduled. I am a 8 p.m. to 11 a.m. intermittent faster.
Love it.
So I really try to make dinner reservations and all that kind of stuff so that like after 8:30 at night, I'm done consuming.
That's so good. I love it. And by the way, you guys, you know, for the younger listeners, you guys don't have to do this because you're young and I hate
you.
No, I'm getting
different.
Yeah.
And you may but have this different is challenges. We're talking about 50 plus year old challenges.
This is like, well, I'd even go 48 plus because some women go into anytime they're perimenopausal. Exactly.
Well, someone who's on a weight loss journey has lost a good amount of weight is really and creating a new routine for themselves. There's also people out there that need to gain weight.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, let me ask you a question. What's it like to go on one of your retreats? Because you have a retreat coming up in Alabama.
Yes.
And I was like, that was random, Alabama.
But it's random. It's random. And it's really exciting because it's really about the PCH group, which is the hotel group that I'm working with to launch these retreats and these facilities.
Tell us about it.
So I'll quickly tell you why I partner with PCH because it's kind of a cool story. There is this famous golf trail called the Trent Jones Golf Trail, Robert Trent Jones Golf Trail. And there's properties along the golf trail and all these, like anyone who loves golf knows what I'm talking about, or it's a destination for them to hit one of these Robert Trent Jones courses. But the facilities around the courses, like the accommodations, weren't really that great. So PCH Group, which is affiliated with Marriott, was smart enough to buy up these properties and turn them into 5-star luxury resorts and spas. So they're renaming it the Robert Trent Jones Golf and Spa Trail. Golf is a really wonderful thing to do. There's so many wonderful things about golfing, right? But on the other side of being in the outdoors, there's also the wellness side. And what can you do when you're indoors? How do you recover? So I was contracted with them to bring awareness to the new hotel openings by hosting retreats to show off the spas and show off these amazing properties along this golf trail because they're in rural settings.
Yeah, I was surprised. It's beautiful. Just so you can visualize it. It looks like 5-star hotel in the middle of the wilderness or something. Like it's in stunning environments and the spas look beautiful. They look first rate.
Oh, they're state of the art. And the reason why I did it, Dana, was because my adventure travel really started with my high altitude climbing, which you talked about at the beginning of the show, which was Kilimanjaro, right? And that was like the beginning. I had graduated from nutrition school. I had resigned from the housewives. I had stepped down from Yummy. It was like the new Heather. It was like the rebirthing, the relaunching after all I had experienced, and I needed to get into the mountains. And so, but listen, and the mountains are to me, you know, what some people call it church or a spiritual experience, might be more politically correct today to call it. But the bottom line is that nature is nurture. But climbing to altitude or even hiking for that matter is not for everyone. So I wanted to provide, especially after the pandemic, when we so needed interaction and we so needed to be together, a place that was safe, that people could come, that was non-judgmental, that was in a beautiful environment, that really wanted us there. You know, PCH Hotel Groups, they wanted us there. So from the Grand Hotel to in Opelika, to the Gulf Shores, Alabama, to now Birmingham at the beautiful Ross Bridge Retreat. I've been working with them to do the retreats. And the other thing I'm really excited about is a partnership with H3, which is Hilton Head Health in Hilton Head, South Carolina, which is really based in food. It's called Fresh Freedom. They're my Fresh Freedom retreats. And it really attacks our relationship with food, or a relationship we thought we understood, and then we turned 50 and we like don't think we understand it anymore.
Yeah, it betrayed me. That.
Yeah. So I love the retreats, and they are a day in the life of one of them is you feel like you're scared, like you don't know why you're going, or you know exactly why you're going, but you're not sure what to anticipate. And then you get there and it's like,
well, what do you do? What the hell do you do in a retreat?
I know. Start with a reception where everybody kind of gets to know each other. And we talk about some of the things we want to get done for the week. And of course, I have a whole series of events planned that is an itinerary that's shown before people sign up. So there's different types of retreats. There's mind, body, soul. There's pure adventure. There's, you know, focus more on food and cooking. But they all touch on what is important as individuals to each of us. So there are workshops, there are meditative workshops, there are music bowl, cleansing, there's spa experiences, there's outdoor experiences to raise up your adrenaline or take you outside of your comfort zone. Go get
it. So you sign up for like individual things, or do you come in and you give them a, like 10 things?
So I keep the groups tight. So the maximum amount of people that I allow on a retreat is 20. Some of them I do are only 6 people.
So they come in and you like say, okay, we're doing this class together. Then we're doing this activity together. Then we're going to have lunch together. Then we're going to go have an evening hour together or something like that. Right.
All of that. And then these are free times where you can do your own thing and you don't have to be a part of the group.
That's
cool. Like sometimes I may have like, a psychologist, you know, where we're doing group sessions and group therapies. And then there's the continuum where you can continue with the psychologist or, you know, food retreats, you know.
So you know, I'm laughing because I'm imagining that one of the Housewives franchises, you know how they do these healing group trips, like every show now that's like,
they do. Oh God. They're so trendy.
No. So they're doing like on almost every franchise, like they had the healing trip after the big fight and all of the women go away together. And I'm imagining them showing up at your retreat.
Oh my God. Well, listen, I'd be happy to host them. You know, some may call me altruistic, even though I can't say the word.
Altruistic.
Yes. Thank you. You say it. What am I?
Altruistic.
Oh. But really, I'm just...
I love you because you know, you are serious about what you're into, but you don't take yourself too seriously. And you've been through a lot of shit, and you are the most positive human being I have ever met. I mean it, Heather.
Aww.
What you went through with, you know, your family and everything, and you're just so positive. I just have to say it. You should be a leader in this. Aww, like, this is your calling. I'm so glad you're hosting these retreats. Now, can I ask you a question? What the hell was it like to get at the top of Kilimanjaro?
Oh, girl. So the best answer to this is truly it wasn't about the summit. So for anybody, I know that sounds really crazy. It was a great reward, but the true trip happened at the beginning and after the summit. You know what I mean? Like, so, and you know, cause not everybody summits also on these trips for various reasons, you know.
Isn't it hard? Like, can't you die on it and everything?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, altitude is real. And when you're getting up to 19,000 feet, you know, you're dealing in real altitude, and it hits people differently. And there are definitely measures that we take to prepare for a trip like this to make sure that we have, you know, all the necessary tools in our toolbox, and not necessarily with advice from lowland doctors, but really high altitude medics and climbers that have been, you know, up there and understand things like Everest, right? So you can have pulmonary edema at altitude, but the good news is there are signs for it, and it doesn't have to kill you. You can easily recover from it when you quickly remove yourself from the altitude. So the minute someone starts to convey any types of signs of distress, we just start to take them down. Just take them down and everything gets better.
Can I ask you a question? Did you camp the whole way up?
Yes.
I'm trying to imagine.
It's so good. You got to look. I have a movie from it that somehow I'll have to release one of these days, but
How did you end up on The Real Housewives of New York?
I know. It was like an anomaly. I think I manifested it. I told Adam Glassman on my podcast, my own podcast, In My Heart. I told Adam Glassman, who, for those of you who don't know him, he's a dear friend and just like one of the major creative forces and powers behind the leadership team of Oprah Winfrey. And Adam told him on my podcast that I manifested it, and I did, because when I was home after my son Jax was born and I was home without my newborn and I couldn't get him and he had to stay at the hospital. And I was like in an empty apartment feeling really, really, really sorry for myself that I wasn't home like every other new mom with their new baby and all this stuff. I turned on the television, of course. And what I got hooked on, Dana, was The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Yes, The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. And so I got hooked on it. And because I was a 70s baby and I grew up with Escape from Witch Mountain, Richard's Girls, I was like, oh my God, I got to watch this. You know what
you
I mean?
You even were watching my seasons. We yes, were kindred girl. Spirits from the very beginning.
So that was the first time the first time I ever watched a Real Housewives anything. And then after I watched that, I was like, let me see what the New York one is like. And that's when the first time I met Luann and I met Sonia and I met Ramon. I had never known any of those people. And I literally was like, they need people like me on that show, like real New Yorkers on that show. Like what, like we, I should be on that show. I remember I said that out loud into the universe.
That's
and
brilliant.
I was like, cause it didn't like after watching Beverly Hills and I was working for Beyonce at the time and I was watching the show and I am a New Yorker my whole life. I was like, that's not really like right. And then I learned what the truth of the whole franchise was, that was really Manhattan moms and they cast it for this other thing. And then the franchise of Housewives Orange County took off and they were like, oh, let's make it a franchise. It made sense to me. And I was like, in my head, I was like, well, I should be on that show. I would tell those women where it's at. It was like, literally like a fan, I guess, would probably be now.
I love it. That's so awesome.
And that's how I feel like I manifested it, because then I got literally a cold call at my desk from a casting agent because of my history, because of who I had worked for and what I had accomplished and what I was doing at the time with my current business.
In that way, the casting is bang on. I want to say one thing, right? The casting agents do look for people who are truly, or they used to anyway, right? Who are truly living the life, you know, that they think that they want to depict on the show or emulate. Like they do try to find women who have like careers they think that their audience would like to see or are established, or they might have a home life they're really interested in or a cool house, or, you know, I mean, it can be that basic sometimes. But I do think that in that way, it's nice that the way they approach it when you're in that stage, which is the ideological stage of it, right?
Yes, of course. I mean, there's good in it. How dare we sit here and not say there's good in it? It's just, I think a lot of us, you know, feel they, you know, they wish they could have some more perspective or different perspective or more of the good, more of the funny, less of the produced, less of the drama.
Well, you know what it is too, is that I think you and I think that the Bravo audience can probably handle a lot more than they dish out.
They're intelligent as fuck.
I know. And I know this because obviously I have a huge audience of people that all we do is we use the housewives and pop culture and mysteries and all this stuff to connect in a community environment and sleuth. Okay. And even though sometimes it can come off as, you know, it's nosy or, you know, maybe mischievous or whatever, that the intention is really to share in finding the truth together, whatever that may be, and honoring everybody's viewpoint about the truth, which can range depending on who you are and what your background is. And you're doing the same thing, but through your wellness, which is really funny. You know, you are a deep person. You're a very smart person. You're an accomplished person. You're driven. And it with that particular vehicle, although you were super successful, season 5, 6, 7, 13, although 13 was like Survivor, but just saying, like, you were elevated, and there was a position, I believe, in a different vehicle. Like, that vehicle's just right. A little too limiting for people like us. Found it that way too. Because, like, I was like, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that's really interesting in my life besides the fact that my friend is getting beat up by her husband. You know, like...
Right. You know, I remember the $30,000 glasses.
Yeah, the $25,000. I wish they were 30. Did you know? Yeah. So, you know, and that's all good. And I, you know, I knew that it was them being cheeky and silly and all those things. And that side I didn't mind. It was actually when it's no other meat to it besides.
No, exactly. But Dana, what if they had actually shown then who you were before the 25,000 and after the 20, like, that to me is the missing opportunity.
And that's why we're making the money now. That's right, bitch. You left it behind.
But by the way, it's maybe not their missed opportunity. There's no judgment here. Like, at the end of the day, I guess.
Heather, speak for yourself. Heather's elevated. I'm just like, listen, bitches, don't leave money on the table because I'll take it. No.
Well, and that's good because that's what makes the world go round. You see, that's why we would be a great team, right? Because I love that about you. You're like, no, don't do that. I'm like, yeah, but don't forget to look at that. And that's what it's all about.
I can tell right now that everybody was struggling to find any reason to come at you because you're so, like, actually beautiful as a person. It's really hard. I can imagine these housewives, like, there's just nothing to come for her for, really. Like they had to make
that bitch's podcast, what I'm going to do. And then I'm just going to call her names and see how that works.
No, I swear to God, I can totally see this happening. You guys know that, you know, obviously I'm thinking like behind the scenes people and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, they were like so struggling. Like Heather is good hearted all through and through and good intentioned. How do we throw a nuke in that? And they were struggling. And that's what happened. I totally see it now because you genuinely are who you are. You know, this isn't like bullshit. Like you really are this person. You know,
tongue, I guess, too. Like, it's like I'm a very quick talker. Maybe that benefited me as well. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you were good. Holla.
Okay. I'll have to actually give credit to that to Barry Bernstein. She's currently and still to this day. Now she's been, you know, promoted after many, many years of service to an executive producer level on The Housewives. And I do wish her and the franchise so much luck. But when I was doing my lean-in line, she was like, when I was saying it, like, my success is making women look and feel their best. They didn't even really make me, because a lot of times they make you go back to the drawing board 100 times for your tagline. And they didn't. And they were like, we love it. It's so perfect. But we need like a Heatherism. I have these Heatherisms, like, you know, your fat roll is relative. If it's yours, it's yours. Or rock what you got. Like I had these things that I was building my fashion business that I was just coming up with, and they would call them Heatherisms. And she said, I need like a Heatherism at the end. And she was talking my language. And I went really back to my roots of what was the most beautiful, like, come on, bring it on, like, say it.
Holla.
Like, holla. And it was really showed my roots and how impactful my years working for Puffy and culture really, really, really had on me, that was to me a celebratory holla.
I love it. Are you kidding? We all did that back in New York in the day yeah, at the club. Exactly. Hello, what's exactly. up? Exactly. Well, listen, Heather, I love you. And I could talk to you know this for hours and like come up with a million other things because your life is so many other things to even bring up. And you guys, Heather did not come on the show to promote anything. Honestly, I literally wanted to know about this stuff myself because I had looked into her and I was like, oh, that's interesting because of the stuff I'm going through, the journey I'm going through.
Yes. And so, you're so great. I got to pump you up to your listeners. Like, I really enjoyed talking to you, Dana. I really did. And getting to know you through this process. And so I'm grateful for to the Housewives for that alone.
Me too.
And I look forward to more conversations and, you know, more growing together and more journeying, sister. You better show up at one of those retreats and all y'all come on.
Yeah.
Maybe 22 at a time, but there are plenty. And I would love to have you all. So please come join us. Life is good. We just got to make it ours.
Aw, that's awesome. And on that note, have an amazing week, everyone. I feel like I'm going to go build a building by myself.